derechos humanos, que no escuchamos nada, no vemos nada, no vemos por ningún lado ese ministerio y ningún otro organismo de derechos humanos, ni de la OEA, ni de la ONU, no vemos nada. La embajada de Estados Unidos en Honduras se mantiene en silencio.
Porfirio Lobo, el gobernante electo durante el régimen golpista, ofreció el miércoles $150,000 por información que lleve a la captura de los asesinos del periodista Ángel Alfredo Villatoro.
Nos tienen miedo porque no tenemos miedo. Nos tienen miedo porque no tenemos miedo. Nos tienen miedo porque no tenemos miedo. Nos tienen miedo porque no tenemos miedo.
Profesores y estudiantes chilenos de secundaria, colegios y universidades protagonizaron el miércoles la segunda marcha multitudinaria del año en la capital, Santiago. Los líderes del movimiento surgido el año pasado expresaron que continuarán hasta que se termine con el sistema educativo instaurado durante la dictadura. Además, pidieron al Congreso no aprobar la reforma tributaria propuesta por el gobierno de Sebastián Piñera porque perpetúa la desigualdad en Chile, aseguraron. Gabriel Boric es el presidente de la Federación de Estudiantes de la Universidad de Chile.
Los estudiantes no estamos para hacer política en la medida de lo posible, estamos para empujar esos límites. Y hoy día lo que le queremos decir al gobierno, a los parlamentarios, a la sociedad en general, a la ciudadanía, es que estamos pidiendo una reforma tributaria que distribuya la riqueza en Chile, para poder tener una reforma educacional que garantice la educación como un derecho social universal, que nos devuelva la educación a todos los chilenos. No estamos pidiendo tanto. La educación tiene que ser un derecho para todos.
La líder universitaria Camila Vallejo recordó que el gobierno no solo rechazó la propuesta estudiantil de aumentar el pago de impuestos a los más ricos, sino que les baja el porcentaje. Asimismo, respondió a las declaraciones del ministro de Educación, Harald Beyer, quien señaló la educación gratuita es injusta y una política regresiva.
Que no se cargara tanto a las familias más pobres, sino que las grandes, los más ricos, ¿cierto?, y las grandes empresas de este país pagaran impuestos para contar con los recursos suficientes para financiar esto. ¿Y qué es lo que tenemos hoy día? Un ajuste tributario que es profundamente injusto. Aquí hay una política de injusticia aberrante. ¿Qué es lo que se está haciendo? Bajar los impuestos a la renta a los más ricos de Chile. ¿Qué es lo que se está haciendo en no eliminar un mecanismo legal para que las grandes empresas hagan elusión tributaria? Y eso es inconcebible. Esta manifestación dice relación con la defensa de la educación pública, gratuita y de calidad, pero también una manifestación contra la injusticia. Se señalaba que la gratuidad era injusta. Y yo le quiero decir no solamente al gobierno, sino que a todas las familias chilenas, de que lo injusto es que se le disminuya los impuestos a la renta a los más ricos. De que lo injusto es que a través de nuestra gran riqueza, el cobre, unos pocos se vean beneficiados y no la gran mayoría a través de la educación pública gratuita y para todos. Eso es lo injusto. Y creemos que hoy día es una demostración de consecuencia y de compromiso con este país que nosotros salgamos a manifestarnos y le pongamos freno a estas medidas que lo único que hacen es profundizar políticas de segregación socioeducativa y profundizar políticas que atentan contra la posibilidad de avanzar en mayores condiciones de igualdad para Chile.
El gobierno chileno continúa ofreciendo becas para los alumnos más pobres y préstamos bancarios a los estudiantes. La marcha del miércoles convocó a 100,000 personas movilizadas pacíficamente, según cálculos de los organizadores. Al final de la jornada hubo 70 detenidos en incidentes menores.
Estás escuchando el informativo Pacífica. Si deseas comunicarte con nosotros, puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblossinfronteras@gmail.com.
De muerte, que son de vida, son todo un pueblo de compañeros. Todos hermanos, cientos de miles por todo Chile.
En la ciudad de Chicago siguen esta semana las acciones de protesta a solo días del inicio de la cumbre de la Organización del Tratado del Atlántico Norte, OTAN, el brazo armado de Estados Unidos y Europa. El martes se realizaron marchas por el centro de Chicago en protesta por la política migratoria, militar y económica de Estados Unidos. El miércoles se organizó una acción para demandar la imposición de una moratoria de un año en las ejecuciones hipotecarias. Se espera que la mayor movilización ocurra el domingo, cuando inicie la cumbre de la OTAN. Integrantes del movimiento Occupy llegarán desde diferentes ciudades de Estados Unidos para condenar el militarismo de la OTAN y exigir el fin de la guerra en Afganistán. Residentes de la capital colombiana, Bogotá, realizaron el miércoles un meeting por la paz en el lugar donde un explosivo detonó el martes.
Manifestaciones como estas se tienen que repetir todo el tiempo para que podamos salir todos, para que nos unamos todos en torno a la causa y que por fin digamos no a la guerra, sí a la paz.
Se está expresando a favor de la paz, que la ciudadanía se cansó y definitivamente le dice no al terrorismo, provenga de donde provenga.
Expertos advierten que el atentado contra el exministro del Interior, Fernando Londoño, ocurrió durante la discusión en el Congreso colombiano de un marco legal que posibilitaría futuros acuerdos de paz con los grupos armados. León Valencia es director de la organización Arco Iris.
Cada vez que se discute en el país temas de paz, siempre la extrema derecha se atraviesa en cualquier proceso de negociación y eso ha sido una historia, o cada que hay una polarización política, y en este momento hay una polarización política entre el presidente Santos y el expresidente Uribe.
Las amenazas de muerte contra el defensor de los migrantes, el padre Alejandro Solalinde, provienen de grupos que están al servicio de políticos influyentes y narcotraficantes en México. Así lo aseguró el propio Solalinde, director del albergue para migrantes Hermanos en el Camino de Ixtepec, Oaxaca. El religioso católico responsabilizó al exgobernador oaxaqueño Ulises Ruiz Ortiz de cualquier agresión en su contra o de los miembros de su equipo.
Queda claro que una de estas personas que ha estado luchando a morir para quitar el albergue, le pedí primero que se comprara el terreno, después que se pusiera, negándonos la construcción, negándonos todo, y después luchando en instancias internacionales como la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos el 20 de marzo de 2010, es un Ulises. No es el único, y por supuesto que él no es el único que está muy interesado en que todo esto se quite. Hay que investigarlo, ahí es una mafia bastante grande y estamos tocando intereses muy grandes, yo lo sé.
Afirmó que los ataques pueden venir del crimen organizado o del gobierno porque ya no hay diferencia entre ellos.
Lo que quieren ellos es esa plaza comercial de los seres humanos, de la vida de los seres humanos en todo o en parte, vivos o muertos, que es el mismo Ciudad Ixtepec. Ellos están peleando.
En conferencia de prensa el martes, Alejandro Solalinde explicó que saldrá temporalmente del país el 21 de mayo. El padre visitará Europa, Canadá y Estados Unidos. En este último país llevará a la sede de la ONU su caso y la situación de los migrantes centroamericanos en México.
En México, los diarios informan sobre 3 masacres y más de 100 muertos en 2 semanas, el descubrimiento de 10 cabezas de personas decapitadas en el sur del país y tratados de extradición entre la nación azteca y Colombia, mientras que en California, los mexicanos residentes del sudoeste de la Unión Americana tratan por cualquier medio de informarse sobre lo que ocurre en su país de origen, especialmente los temas relacionados con la violencia. Eso quedó claro en días pasados en la Feria del Libro en Español en el Centro de Convenciones en Los Ángeles. Los ejemplares sobre el narco y la violencia se agotaron para sorpresa de algunos escritores. Francisco Tamayo fue uno de los compradores.
Pues yo, como tengo muchos familiares en México, quisiera que ellos ya no me platicaran que se sienten inseguros en México.
Guillermo Hernández.
Yo creo que ese es el sentir de todos los mexicanos que estamos de este lado. Porque independientemente de que dejemos, muchos están ya con familias enteras aquí, pero muchos dejan las raíces allá también. Es que pienso que está en peligro la sociedad.
Por su parte, el escritor Ricardo Robelo, autor de El Narco en México, explicó algunas similaridades entre la guerra en Colombia, la injerencia estadounidense y las supuestas soluciones que promueve Washington.
Estados Unidos tomó medidas, tomó el control del Estado colombiano, se estableció lo que en aquel momento se conoció como el Plan Colombia. ¿Pero qué pasó en Colombia? ¿Realmente se derrotó al narco? Resulta que no ocurrió absolutamente nada. Después de la caída de los cárteles de Medellín y de Cali, hoy Colombia es el país que exporta más droga que en la época más boyante de estas dos organizaciones criminales. Hoy el narcotráfico en Colombia está controlado por el propio Estado, protegido por la policía, por los militares. Lo que pasa es que los niveles de violencia ya son menores.
Robelo habló después sobre la situación de México y en particular de los negocios de Joaquín El Chapo Guzmán y sus relaciones con autoridades norteamericanas y mexicanas.
cártel de Sinaloa, algunos miembros provienen del cártel de Juárez, otros provienen del cártel de Guadalajara, de tal suerte que todo aquel grupo que encabezó hasta el año 97, Amado Carrillo Fuentes, hoy se aglutina en lo que se conoce como cártel de Sinaloa, organización que se afirma en expedientes, incluso abiertos en territorio americano, que ha contado con protección incluso de la DEA, obviamente de la policía mexicana, y que existe un pacto desde el año 2002, cuando se fugó el Chapo Guzmán, que se da cuenta en este libro, para lograr que la narcoempresa conocida como Sinaloa sentara sus reales en todo el territorio mexicano y creciera como ha crecido a la fecha, ¿no? Es una organización que hoy en México controla 25 estados, pero está presente en más de 50 países del mundo.
San Juana Martínez es autora de La Frontera del Narco y otros 8 libros y ganadora del Premio Nacional de Periodismo en México. Ella nos habló de la política norteamericana en la región.
Siempre ha tenido una intención de controlar los distintos países de América Latina. De hecho, los asesinatos de periodistas en Honduras se da por el contexto de la gente más favorecida, de las clases altas, apoyadas por Estados Unidos en este nuevo gobierno que está en Honduras. Entonces, en la región, Estados Unidos tiene intereses particulares muy importantes para ellos y no están dispuestos a ceder en cuanto a permitir gobiernos de una ideología progresista. Ellos quieren que continúe la presencia de la ideología conservadora. Esa es su hegemonía, de esa manera controlan el país, ¿no?
Está bien documentado que la población norteamericana representa poco más del 5% de la gente que vive en el mundo, pero consume más del 60% de las drogas ilegales del planeta. Esto sugiere que la red de distribución de drogas más grande del orbe se encuentra en la Unión Americana, pese a la presencia del FBI, la DEA y otras famosas entidades policiales. ¿Acaso Estados Unidos tiene algo que ver con la violencia en México? De nuevo, la periodista San Juana Martínez.
Claro, mira, aquí la pregunta es, ¿por qué la droga que en México provoca 60.000 muertos, 30.000 desaparecidos, 20.000 huérfanos, 250.000 desplazados, en Estados Unidos, al cruzar la frontera, se vuelve pacífica? ¿Por qué? ¿Por qué nosotros ponemos los muertos y Estados Unidos pone los consumidores?
La autora de En Bancos Confiamos, Penny Lenoux, dijo una vez que en la Florida entran los capos al banco a preguntar cuánto les cobran por guardar toneladas de dinero allí dentro o tratan de comprar la institución bancaria con dinero en efectivo. También el New York Times ha informado que la policía antinarcóticos norteamericana, la DEA, lava dinero para los capos mexicanos. ¿Acaso San Juana Martínez sabe algo sobre el tema?
Por supuesto, en los bancos de Miami. Ahí están todos los lavadores. Apenas hace la semana pasada el Departamento de Estado ya se dio cuenta que el Chapo Guzmán tiene 2 hijos lavadores de dinero. Si tienen años lavando dinero en Estados Unidos, que no se hagan. Es una hipocresía por parte del gobierno estadounidense.
Entre los mexicanos que asistieron a la Feria del Libro en Español en la ciudad de Los Ángeles estaban Omar López y una mujer que le acompañaba. Ellos se mostraron incrédulos sobre el sistema electoral de su país.
En México, la gente no veo por qué se hace bolas en votar por un candidato cuando ellos eligen el candidato que se va a quedar el presidente. Ellos mismos los cogen. No, nunca.
Siempre a alguien de alto mando.
Eso siempre se ha sabido.
Por su parte, la galardonada periodista San Juana Martínez apunta a algo que quizá muchos mexicanos todavía no toman en cuenta, como en su momento nadie creía que el tricolor que patentara la dictadura perfecta pudiera caer después de más de 70 años en el poder.
Por primera vez se ve la posibilidad de que no gane el PRI ni el PAN. Las encuestas están manejadas por los poderosos y son encuestas manipuladas y lo hemos demostrado. Yo creo que hay un despertar de las conciencias gracias al movimiento de Morena, no gracias a los partidos y que representa Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Yo creo que de ahí va a venir el verdadero cambio. Que van a intentar por todos los cauces evitarlo, ya lo están haciendo. Todo el poder económico y el poder financiero, el poder mediático está a favor de Peña Nieto, pero el pueblo está a favor de Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
En tanto, en Estados Unidos, los millones de mexicanos que viven sin documentos migratorios ya han empezado a caer en grandes cantidades en las garras del complejo industrial carcelario. La periodista Rena Razor reveló la semana pasada que las empresas Corrections Corporation of America Ortega y Grupo Gio han descubierto la fórmula perfecta para aumentar sus ganancias. Con ayuda del Consejo Americano de Intercambio Legislativo y varios políticos, han logrado aprobar la ley SB-1070 en Arizona, la misma que han exportado a más de 20 estados. La criminalización de los migrantes se ha traducido en más de 1.600 millones de dólares anuales para CCA y más de 1.100 millones de dólares para el Grupo Gio. Si la Suprema Corte de Justicia de la Nación aprueba la ley Arizona, el número de mexicanos enviados a largas sentencias de prisión será aún mayor, dándole al sector privado la oportunidad de contratar presos mexicanos por menos de $5 al día. La Corte Suprema bien podría aliviar la precaria situación económica norteamericana, dándole a millones de mexicanos trabajo de tiempo completo. De la misma forma que los negros secuestrados en África tuvieron trabajo de tiempo completo como esclavos en Norteamérica por más de 300 años. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
One day more, people. Tell you what we're fighting for our future, don't you understand? And we don't need your pity, we just need your helping hand.
Estás escuchando el informativo Pacífica.
Los invitamos a visitar nuestro blog en pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com.
Puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblosinfronteras@gmail.com.
Estudiantes de la Universidad Veracruzana y del Instituto Tecnológico de Orizaba denunciaron haber sido agredidos antes del mitin político del candidato a la presidencia por el PRI, Enrique Peña Nieto. Los jóvenes que planeaban protestar en el acto fueron golpeados por hombres, algunos con cortes de pelo estilo militar. Según testigos, la policía local detuvo a los jóvenes ultrajados. Los estudiantes únicamente llevaban pancartas y máscaras de papel con rostros del expresidente Carlos Salinas, a quien se considera el cerebro de la campaña de Peña Nieto. La Asociación Metropolitana de Estudiantes de Veracruz denunció que varios jóvenes encarcelados solo fueron liberados después de pagar una fianza, mientras que a los agresores, integrantes de Juventud Dinámica y policías vestidos de civil, no se les castigó por la agresión física. No somos porros ni acarreados, afirmaron estudiantes que el pasado viernes participaron en una ruidosa protesta contra el candidato a la presidencia del PRI, Enrique Peña Nieto.
Estimados Joaquín Caldwell,
Arturo Escobar,
Emilio Gamboa,
así como medios de comunicación,
de dudosa neutralidad.
Usamos el derecho de réplica para desmentirlos.
Somos estudiantes de Libero.
No acarreados, no porros.
Y nadie nos entrenó para nada.
131 jóvenes realizaron un video mostrando sus credenciales, diciendo sus nombres y números de cuenta para probar que estudian en la Universidad Iberoamericana, donde Peña Nieto debió salir apresurado por la puerta trasera.
Mi nombre es María José L. Mi cuenta de alumnos es 172236-9. Somos estudiantes de la Ibero.
Alejandra Miranda, M170675-1.
De esa manera respondieron a las declaraciones de los dirigentes de los partidos PRI y Verde Ecologista de México, que los acusaron de no pertenecer a la universidad.
Soy Camila de la Universidad Iberoamericana.
La Asamblea Popular por el Agua en la provincia de Mendoza, Argentina, vuelve a ponerse en guardia frente a la propuesta de un congresista que quiere modificar una ley que prohíbe el uso de sustancias tóxicas en las explotaciones mineras. Claudio Andrés de Luca reporta.
Sorprendidos y en alerta, así están los integrantes de la Asamblea Popular por el Agua de la provincia de Mendoza, después de conocer el pedido de un legislador que quiere modificar una ley para hacerla más flexible. Esta ley básicamente
prohíbe el uso de sustancias tóxicas en cualquier explotación minera, siendo cianuro, mercurio, ácido sulfúrico y cualquier otra sustancia tóxica.
Federico Blonda, de la Asamblea Popular por el Agua.
A su vez, obliga a que haya una rectificación legislativa para la aprobación de cualquier proyecto megaminero.
Esta ley es una traba real y concreta al avance de las empresas megamineras. Se sancionó en 2007 por presión del pueblo de Mendoza, que despertaba ante la amenaza de la megaminería.
Si una ley se somete a modificaciones dentro del proceso legislativo, pueden modificarla toda. Entonces nosotros nos vamos a oponer, vamos a sacar a la gente de la casa en caso de ser necesario y a su vez vamos a hacer toda la presión legal y política que sea necesaria, como la venimos haciendo hace ya 6 años.
denuncian que el gobernador recibe presiones para que comiencen los proyectos mineros que están parados. Él, durante la campaña electoral, prometía respetar la ley, pero ahora se muestra promotor de estas empresas. Desde la Asamblea advierten que no van a permitir ningún cambio en la ley y, si es necesario, volverán a la calle y a la legislatura para defenderla. Desde Argentina, Claudio Andrés de Luca, Aire Libre, Radio Comunitaria.
La presidenta de Brasil, Dilma Rousseff, juramentó el miércoles a los integrantes de una Comisión de la Verdad que investigará los crímenes cometidos durante la dictadura militar.
La ignorancia sobre la historia no pacifica, al contrario, mantiene latentes resentimientos y rencores. La desinformación no contribuye a la paz, solamente facilita el camino para la intolerancia. La sombra y la mentira no son capaces de promover la conciliación. Brasil merece la verdad, las nuevas generaciones merecen la verdad.
Sin embargo, la Comisión de la Verdad, que abarcará los años 1946 hasta 1988, no enviará a ningún represor a la cárcel, porque sigue vigente una ley absolutoria para el régimen militar. El Palacio de Bellas Artes de la Ciudad de México fue el lugar donde se rindió un homenaje público de cuerpo presente al escritor Carlos Fuentes, fallecido por complicaciones derivadas de un sangrado del tubo digestivo. Su ataúd, cubierto con una bandera mexicana, fue recibido con aplausos. El multipremiado autor de 60 libros como La región más transparente, La muerte de Artemio Cruz y Aura tenía 83 años de edad. El jefe de la Ciudad de México, Marcelo Ebrard, dijo que a Fuentes le indignaba la escandalosa desigualdad económica en el país.
Progresista liberal, nacionalista patriota, le indignaba la escandalosa desigualdad mexicana. Era ante todo la fraude de la esperanza mexicana.
Carlos Fuentes había criticado la llamada guerra contra el narcotráfico de Felipe Calderón y se pronunció a favor de legalizar las drogas.
La oferta es mexicana y es criminalizada. La demanda es norteamericana y nadie la criminaliza.
En una de sus últimas entrevistas declaró su apoyo al candidato a la presidencia de México, Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
Siento que los problemas son muy grandes y los candidatos muy pequeños. Claro que tengo una inclinación a favor de López Obrador por ser de izquierda, porque están muchos amigos míos ahí. Pero creo que hay que tomar conciencia de que esta es una época de transformación profunda de México, que hay que hacer políticas que no se han hecho, que están pendientes en todos los campos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
My name is Brad Johnson. I'm a former Clear Channel radio engineer, and when I'm in Santa Cruz, I listen to Freak Radio Santa Cruz.
Next up on Free Radio, it's Bathurst Spears Broadsides. You are tuned to 101.3 FM, www.well. What is our stream anyway? I guess go to TuneIn. Look in your browser for TuneIn.com, and you'll find the secret to that question. 101.3, of course, is not happening. You are on the stream because we are in need of equipment, and we're struggling to get our equipment back together again. But any donations, hey, would be much appreciated. Go to the Free Radio Santa Cruz website at freakradio.org if you want to help out, freakradio.org. Or you can give a quick check in the mail to FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7811, and the zip code is Santa Cruz 95061. So check that one out. In the meantime, let's listen to a little something from The House That Took Me by Tether Horse.
Looking.
that indeed was in the house that took me. At least the actual number is Further From Morning, but that's the name of the album. Tether Horse. Well, welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Going to pick up on a few older interviews today, plus give you a few brief updates. Who knows, we may be getting a call from Mark Garcia of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. I spoke to him yesterday. He may be calling in. He could give us updates on the struggle to overturn the sitting ban known as Sit Lie in San Francisco, as well as other activities of the Coalition in its latest attempts to play patty cake with City Hall. There's apparently they had some hope in a new supervisor. Bevan, his name is, but apparently that hasn't been fulfilled, or the hopes have not been realized. But we'll be hoping to get, I'll be hoping anyway, to get some new information on that if he calls in. Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco is interested in the harassment of activists down here, and so I heard that on Monday they voted or consensed or got together to agree to support dismissing all charges against the Santa Cruz 11 activists down here. I'm one of them who've been charged with trespass, conspiracy, vandalism, and a bunch of false accusations, which essentially are punishment for active participation and reporting of peaceful protests that involved not a single arrest. Of course, then 2 months later, they went after activists and did arrest them in their homes. And there's actually a hearing coming up tomorrow on that same subject at 8:15 in the morning. It's a little unclear. I had heard the judge say 8:15. It's also been noted, claimed to be 8:30, but in any case, if you show up early, you won't miss it. It's an interesting hearing, and the papers are already online for you to look at. Concerns two reporter activists, Bradley Stewart and Alex DeRosi, great photographers and reporters who do a lot of reporting on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. You can check them out. They cover a lot of events. They were covering the 75 River Street takeover of the vacant bank on River Street, left vacant by Wells Fargo Bank, which charges $28,000 a month to lease it, as I understand it. So they, for some reason, didn't get any takers. And the barbed wire fence surrounded bank, and it wasn't surrounded by a fence or barbed wire last November when people chose to occupy it for 3 days to apparently to dramatize the need for a community center, as has happened in other cities throughout the country. But unlike in other cities, some of the activists who were present and some of the reporters who were present have been charged with a huge number of, total of 22 felonies are being charged against all those activists, or were. Four of the activists had all charges discharged against them about a week ago by Judge Burdick. But the eager district attorney, Rebecca Young, has declared she's refiling charges against two, so that'll make it actually the Santa Cruz 9. But I think it's the 11, because the two that, at least one of them, Grant Wilson, whose charges were discharged, has been an active part of fighting these charges for the rest of us, and I'm very grateful to him for joining in that struggle, as well as to anybody else out there who is standing up for just the right of people to report on these things, the right of people to peacefully protest. If somebody is engaged in vandalism, well, good, arrest them for vandalism. That's a different matter. Anyway, these issues are coming up tomorrow in court, and attorneys for Alex and Bradley are arguing that the charges should all be dismissed, and that there's a case of selective prosecution happening because mainstream reporters who were also in the building and so guilty of, quote, trespass under the theories of prosecutor Rebecca Young and her overlord Bob Lee should apply to them, but they don't. So the prosecution has chosen alternate media, and they're punishing a point of view. They're punishing people who are putting out information that the mainstream media is either taking a different slant on or not putting out at all. And that's coming up tomorrow, 8:15 or 8:30 thereabouts, Department 6. Check it out. Come on down and see what happens. It could be quite a victory. It could be a defeat. It could be a mixed matter. We'll see what happens. Check it out. Then later that day, at 3 o'clock at India Joe's restaurant is going to be what's called a Save the 11 for the 11 event, which is going to be kind of a benefit for the Santa Cruz 11. Are those of us that remain struggling in court around that issue, hopefully a dwindling number. And that's going to be at India Joe's restaurant at 418 Front Street. You can donate as little as a dollar or as much as $50,000, whatever you'd like to do. Come on in and check it out. I'm actually going to be playing some tape shortly from the previous event that we had at India Joe's where Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bomb, spoke. And that was way back in March 25th, actually, now. And I've been playing selections. Well, not selections. I've been kind of working my way through that taped event. And we'll hear some more of it today, as well as a clip or two from the spoken edition of Les Miserables, which is to say the huge volume written by Victor Hugo in the 19th century and performed by George Guidel, and that's he's quite a speaker. Now, I'm not going to hear too much of him, but we'll hear some of it. I found some stuff particularly moving and thought that it might be pertinent to those interested in the subjects that Victor Hugo covered. It's a story in one level of, well, we'll talk about that when it comes up, which will be shortly. In the meantime, you can also give a call in if you have any breaking news. I know there's been headlines in the paper recently about the deaths of the murders of two individuals, one a hit and run. A homeless guy, I'm told, Josh. Another, the murder of a woman named Shannon, who owned Camouflage, the business downtown on Pacific Avenue. And there's been some discussion of that. Sentinel's been using it as a drum to, well, they've mentioned, they've attacked homeless people generally as a, or homeless advocates. Maybe attack is a little strong, but certainly some of the, well, the usual nasty crapola that's put out by the upfront bigots on the Sentinel website. That it's actually the Topics website that the Sentinel uses. I think it's Topics. In any case, it's where you leave the comments if you're checking out the online edition of the Sentinel newspaper. If you have any thoughts on that, feel free to call in and talk about it. Since I didn't know either of the people who were killed personally, and I try to really stay pretty close to my own feelings on these kinds of personal issues, I don't really have too much to say about these deaths. Obviously, death anywhere is a sobering thing. Murder is an even more sobering thing. But I'm always wary when these things are used for political purposes. And when we start hearing the attacks on homeless people as a general phenomenon, or start seeing police cracking down, which I'm told anecdotally may be happening, and I don't have any clear and accurate reports on that. I'd like to know more about that from folks out there, if you've seen that happening recently or not happening recently. I'd like to know about it. 427-3772 is the phone number, 427-3772. Give a call in and let me know what you've seen, what you've heard, what you're thinking, and what you want to say, and we'll, you know, I'll listen, and I think you'll get some other people listening on the stream, and maybe if they review the archives, that'll happen later. I apologize to those folks who tried to listen to last week's show on the archives. Some of it, for some reason, was just simply gone. You can hear my voice when I make commentary on some of the street interviews, but the street interviews themselves, at least the initial parts of them, are hard to hear or not audible at all, and that's for those of you who have had the interest or the diligence or the foolishness to check out the archives. I may be able to fix that in the future, but don't hold your breath. I'm going to see what I can do if there was a better copy in the studio, but I kind of think maybe that didn't happen either, but we'll see what went down. Hopefully that won't happen again. If anybody has problems hearing me or anything that's happening on the show, please do call in, 427-3772. Let me know, and I'll try in my fumbling and amateurish manner. I'll try my own in a sort of a limited way to try to deal with it, and we'll see how that goes. So, Without further ado, or out further do-do, let me pass on to finishing up the March 25th event at India Joe's. Again, there's one tomorrow from 3 to 6 again, but this was a very important, I think, and very educational event because co-founder of Food Now Bombs activist Keith McHenry spoke at it. He's a wonderful speaker, and more than that, he's a great activist whose work has been the inspiration for literally probably millions around the world, but certainly thousands or tens of thousands of people. There have been, I think, hundreds if not thousands of Food Not Bombs that have independently been formed by people throughout the world because of his work. Food Not Bombs is an organization which, as the title says, suggests that the priorities of the country ought to be food, not bombs, and doesn't just sit around, you know, waving pamphlets or, you know, talking about it on the radio like I do, but they actually feed people every week. They have a banner of Food Not Bombs. They do so in public places that dramatize the numbers of people that are still hungry, and as a result, they are attacked by authorities frequently. In places like Orlando and other places that are supposed to be liberal, like Santa Cruz and San Francisco, though those two cities have not gone after Food Not Bombs in quite a while, mainly because Food Not Bombs and the community stood up to those attacks. We didn't win in court at all. I think there's still an injunction, maybe it's lapsed, against Food Not Bombs in Santa Cruz. There certainly was one, is one in San Francisco. I was jailed under it, spent a month in jail up there. But Food Not Bombs continued to serve even as I was jailed on the steps of the jail, and then after that they continued to serve. And that's similarly in Orlando. I did a lot on this last summer when the federal court upheld, unfortunately, the Orlando regulation, which is being apparently emulated by other cities in Florida too, to essentially stop Food Now Bombs and other organizations that want to feed publicly poor and homeless people because it embarrasses businesses and reportedly deters tourists, or really more fundamentally shows how the current system isn't working and that there's a real visible misery and hunger around. Action by activists who are willing to take tickets, go to jail, continue to feed people anyway, resulted in the mayor's backing down in Orlando. And people have been fed, I think, daily or at least twice a week. I think it's twice a week in Orlando. Right on the right outside the mayor's downtown offices in the park there in Orlando. So, that unfortunately is not going to be what we're going to be having tomorrow at the 3 to 6, 11, save the 11 for the 11th rally or event, but you can meet some of the 11. I'll be there. Think of that. You can touch me if you want, possibly even hug me. Never can tell if, you know, if we both agree. We can chat. You can give your own thoughts. You can essentially support them, us, if you'd like. And that, again, is at 418 Front Street at 3 o'clock tomorrow, Friday, the 11th of May. Here's some tape from the March 25th event that happened also at India Joe's. And without further ado, let's hear some of it.
I'm going to hand it over to her in a minute. But this is the part of the program where we get to introduce our special host today, the man that everyone knows, the man who fed us tonight, Mr. Joseph Schultz.
There he is!
The man who made the legend.
And still standing.
And he is here to receive a very special proclamation from another very famous man. Also is well known, Mr. Don Lane, our mayor of Santa Cruz.
Hey!
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today. It's really great.
Behave yourself.
No.
I always have the honor of giving people proclamations, making mayor's proclamations, and this is really a special occasion today because I've known Joseph for at least 30 years. I'd say we've both been in the restaurant business. We were never competitors except around mud pie. But anyway, I've known Joseph's great work for a long time in the food world, and so I was happy to, with the help of others, prepare this proclamation. And here it goes. Whereas Joseph Schultz is well known as a culinary ambassador of an international cuisine to Santa Cruz, California, and whereas Joseph Schultz is a participant and founder of many local events and festivals, including the Calamari Festival, Fungus Fair, Chickpea Festival, Mushroom Festival, etc. And whereas Joseph is an educator, speaker, and author who has spent a lifetime in service to others, celebrating and demystifying the creation of tasty food. And whereas Joseph and his personal philosophy of may all be fed represent the inspiration for the Food Justice Coalition of Santa Cruz. And whereas Joseph is not afraid to use and advocate for the use of salt and butter in ample quantities. And whereas Joseph is a longtime supporter of numerous humanitarian, political, and environmental organizations. And whereas Joseph is known to wear leather aprons and carry 20 pounds of cutlery around his waist while nimbly moving around in a tiny space. And whereas Joseph has been known to bring his culinary creations to locations both remote and public in his noble efforts to bring food to the masses. Now, therefore, I, Don Lane, Mayor of the City of Santa Cruz, do hereby proclaim Sunday, March 25th as May All Be Fed Day. Joseph Schultz and his restaurant India Joe's, and urge all citizens to join me in thanking him for his tireless work and the many positive contributions that he and India Joe's have made to the city of Santa Cruz.
Yes, indeed.
It's wonderful to see a turnout like this for an event like this. And if the other side was represented here better, I would be even happier. Because what I think a restaurant needs to be is a place where all people can dine together and see through their differences. I wanted to talk about work for a second. There's two kinds of work in the world. One involves taking stuff and moving it around on the surface of our beautiful planet. This work is ill-paid if done incorrectly, or if not paid at all, it's done incorrectly. It's not honored. It's of low status. It's sometimes dangerous. It's unpleasant. It's never-ending. It's often done in the company of demoralized and resentful workmates. Then there's the other kind of work. This involves telling other people how and where to move stuff around the surface of our beautiful world. This work is highly paid, whether performed correctly or not. It's done in pleasant surroundings with pleasant colleagues. Amply honored, conferring status and recognition upon the performer, including pay, when the work is no longer even being performed. This is what I believe is called retirement for a few of us. I'm moved and honored that you've gathered together to honor my history here at India Joe's. And India Joe's would not exist without so many people that have helped. That it's hard for me to accept this honor. The many people who have slaved in the kitchens and have worked tirelessly to make sure that this would happen can't all be with us here today. And so I want to dedicate this proclamation to the women especially, because the women are the ones that are the last to be honored and the first to do the work. And the people who never would think of getting honored, I want to think of them first. I'm nothing but a figurehead. Thank
thank you for your continued patronage, and I hope that as you keep coming and keep supporting this venue, that many more events like this and even bigger will help the social justice movement and the justice movement in the largest sense of the word. It's very easy to care about justice in other parts of the world, and there's many people in our town who speak about justice a lot. And I think it's wonderful that there are some people now who are stepping forward and saying, justice in Santa Cruz, economic justice in Santa Cruz. But I just want to say that it's a project very near and dear to my heart, and anything I can do to further that, I will. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And just a word or two of commentary. But some of us heard that Mayor Don Lane, who I've endlessly called Mayor Gone Lame, had come forward to be present as a sort of a featured guest at this rally, which really is not about political figures at all. In fact, Lane is responsible for all kinds of mischief and actually criminal behavior against homeless people in Santa Cruz. I call it criminal because I believe it's a conspiracy to deprive people, homeless people, of their human rights, which is what Lane, as mayor of Santa Cruz, has not only presided over, but has supported in vote after vote at the city council in terms of making laws worse that criminalize people for sleeping outside and so forth. Lane is famous to a lot of folks, maybe to the people listening now, as a verbal defender of the homeless. He's on the board of directors of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which calls itself the Homeless Services Center. He's a big booster of Project Connect, which is a sort of a one-day help out the homeless day, which he spearheads, or he was spearheading in past years. I think he simply was present there and spoke, actually interviewed him there when he was doing that last month. He particularly was notorious for seeming to be in negotiations with Occupy Santa Cruz activists week after week, and then had nothing to say when, and had no critical comment whatsoever when the police smashed and destroyed and uprooted the homeless encampment on December 8th of last year, making 100 to 200 people refugees with the Occupy Santa Cruz. He had nothing to say when the county set up its notorious curfew at the county building and around the county building, on the county building and the courthouse grounds, which I am proud to say I and others were happy to ignore last night when we had another meeting of Occupy Santa Cruz, as we do twice a week now. I think it may even be three times a week. Actually, I think it is twice a week. Is it twice? I don't know. There are two formal meetings. One is Sunday at the courthouse. I'm sorry, the post office, the main post office in the afternoon at 2, and the other is at 6 o'clock on Wednesday, which was the one yesterday I went to. But there's a, again, there is an increasing criminalization of protesters, poor people, and increasing support for police state kinds of actions, which Lane has had nothing critical to say about whatsoever and has supported in every time they came up at city council, with the one exception that he demurred initially, tried to suggest that homeless people should be allowed to sit with their dogs on Pacific Avenue because housed people would be allowed to do that. But if homeless people had a sign that they were looking for any kind of financial support, that would make it illegal for them to do that. And that passed, and Lane eventually voted for that, even though it had that additional provision that homeless people can't do that. So I was hard-pressed not to think of doing something, at least saying something very clearly at that event when Lane was there. But there's a faction that really has a lot of faith in Don Lane's rhetoric and his words, and somehow feels he's a great supporter of the homeless, or even if he isn't, he could somehow be prevailed to do it if people were nice enough and friendly enough to him and chatted with him enough about the human rights issue and so forth, which I think, of course, is delusional. But nonetheless, that's the reality of some folks who are very hard workers otherwise with Occupy Santa Cruz. And the Food and Justice Committee that helped to sponsor Keith McHenry's coming, unfortunately or fortunately, includes a lot of those folks. And I guess I'm reserving my caustic comments here. I was one of the sort of masters of ceremonies of this event. Who knows? Maybe I did say something sort of under my breath when this was all happening, and I was glad that Joe Schultz got his reward. He certainly deserves it. He's gone to jail for serving free food in Santa Cruz, as have I and others. And he's been a regular supporter of Occupy Santa Cruz serving food. Notice the words Occupy Santa Cruz did not appear in Don Lane's proclamation. That's very telling. The only protest that has had any meaningful impact in the last decade, that's a little bit something of an exaggeration. I don't want to sideline groups that have fought for the rights of immigrants and groups that have fought for the rights of gay and transsexual people with some success, but usually, I mean, there hasn't been anything as massive as the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Santa Cruz actions, I think, certainly in the last 10 years that I've seen. There have been some attempts that started, like the Tent University in 2005 up on campus, were crushed by police after one day, which caused a storm of controversy, the kind of torture tactics that they used up there. But nothing like Occupy Santa Cruz. And, of course, that's why it's become a forbidden topic politically. People don't want to praise it because the fear that it might start again. And, indeed, last night's Occupy Santa Cruz General Assembly was larger than previous ones. In the sense that it was larger than I'd say there were 35 people there at its height, which certainly is smaller than the hundreds of people who showed up the first day when the Occupy movement began here in Santa Cruz back on October 4th, I believe it was, thereabouts. But it's also much larger than outdoor protests and meetings that happened a year ago or 2 years ago, generally, and that are happening, and it is happening on a regular basis. And so, I don't know, the idea of Don Lane being celebrated in any way. Of course, they're celebrating Joe Schultz, but, you know, he's being presented with a sort of this bourgeois commercial. Oh, he's a great provider of food, of culinary delights, and so forth. I mean, it is true, Joe Schultz runs a restaurant, and it's a business downtown. He has to survive doing that, and he does. And I hope he does, too. But he also provides a lot more for a lot of other people. And, of course, it would have been nice if I thought of it at the time, that maybe Occupy Santa Cruz provided its own award to Joe Schultz and talked about his real history of activism instead of this sanitized, censored, bourgeoisified stuff that came from Don Lane. And who knows? Maybe we will. Maybe tomorrow will be the appropriate time to do that if he's there. Have to think about that. So, let's hear some more, and I'm not sure how much more actually is going to be either airworthy or, it's probably airworthy, but I don't know if it's actually something we want to listen to, but let's see.
Don't go bankrupt. Go for it. Speak up. Your turn.
My turn?
Your turn.
I think it's Diana's turn. No? I have to say it? There's dessert.
Oh!
Don't go away unless you're allergic to sugar and can admit it. Thank you. Well, I'm going to try to do it. First up, Mark, are you still here? Yeah, don't interrupt yourself if you're eating or doing anything important. But there's a chance we have time for one more song, and I know you got Roadburn. I don't know if you're interested, but we could carve that out in a little while.
Linda LeMaster, who's kind of the mistress of ceremonies.
All right. I had hoped to name all
check it out yourself. And thank you to the people who brought the event together. All kinds of different volunteering came together in a short time. And we're going to have cake as soon as most of you are done eating, but I thought we could use the last few minutes, even though, like I said, Mark, I'm going to be on the driver. If you're up for it, the people want it. GAs that occupy Santa Cruz.
So we have GAs, General Assemblies, 4 days a week.
And this is Joy, who is a really active Santa Cruz, Occupy Santa Cruz person, who I don't always agree with. She's a big fan of Don Lane's. But she's also a hard worker, and we don't have them 4 times a week. I think we have them 3 times at most. I think it's twice a week for sure, Sundays and Wednesdays, as I mentioned before.
Please come down and join us. They're Tuesday and Thursday at the Courthouse Steps on Water Street, and on Saturday and Sunday at the U.S. Post Office.
Yeah.
All right. 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock on Sunday, 6 o'clock on Tuesday and Thursday. Saturday and Sunday, 2 o'clock. 6 o'clock on Tuesday and Thursday. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Those who want to support the Santa Cruz 11, we meet too. We meet every Monday at 3 o'clock at 1416 Mission Street. 1416 Mission Street, 3 o'clock every Monday. So all you fellow felons who haven't yet come out of the closet, come on down and help us out one way or another. Thank you.
We know we have a very large Hispanic population here in Santa Cruz, and I don't know if they're duly represented here at this gathering, but I'm going to do a song called De Colores. If you know it, sing along with it. It's about how we love all the colors. Yes, maybe a favorite color, but we love all the colors.
And that looks like it was it for this particular event. But again, there's going to be a second event tomorrow, so you can be a part of it. It's likely to be significantly smaller, more intimate. How's that? That'd be a good way of putting it. And I'll be there, and so will a number of other folks who have been actively involved in raising issues around, well, around homeless civil rights, around the financial machinations of the big banks, around the war industry, all the stuff that was a focus for a lot of us at Occupy Santa Cruz. And it's still a focus, obviously, because it's still going on and still happening. Right now, a lot of the focus, however, is on defending people who are being attacked by the government for protesting these issues. And there were 11 of us. It conceivably could still be 11, but it looks like that it's been reduced to 9 and maybe reduced further tomorrow morning if Bradley Allen and Alex DeRosi are able to persuade Judge Burdick to stop this charade and this cavalcade of nonsense in its tracks, at least for those two. Then I will be having a hearing on what's called a motion to compel discovery, which will be happening a week from tomorrow. In Department 6 in the morning, and that at probably about 8:15. We've learned today from District Attorney Rebecca Young that the video that's supposed to be available to the defense is not, and therefore this may mean a delay in the trial, or may mean, I'd like to see charges dismissed as a consequence of this kind of stuff, but we're not making a motion to dismiss yet in my case. It's simply a motion to demand, require the district attorney to stop screwing around and provide all the video over the entire period of time that happened at the 75 River Street occupation, so we can see whether so we can see what kind of evidence they supposedly have against me and the others, but also so we can see what kind of selective prosecution is happening. There are a lot of people in there that are not being prosecuted, and nor should anybody be prosecuted, but the idea that they picked out activists that they don't like and are prosecuting them, of course, is completely a violation of due process of law, and it's something that hopefully the community will ultimately not stand for once it's been really informed about what's going on. So we'll see what happens in that motion to compel discovery. DA Rebecca Young has really been notoriously bad. I'm not sure whether it's because she's overburdened, new, incompetent, or just indifferent to this, or maybe even malicious. It's hard to say what the motivation is. I don't think she's malicious. At least that wasn't my initial reading of her when I spoke with her at some length when I was still representing myself. And she was willing to talk to me because I was a defendant. I even thought of interviewing her for free radio to talk about her own history and how she came to Santa Cruz and so forth, to give people a kind of a background on the what's going on with the personal side of the DA's department. In case anybody wants to call in and talk about any of these issues, well, I want to remind you the number here is 427-3772, 427-3772. It looks like my man from San Francisco may not be calling in, although I told him he could call in any time in the next hour and a half if he wants, next hour and 15 minutes, actually. So that could still be happening. In the meantime, I think it's time for a musical break. So break I will, and I'll be back. Don't go away.
Que otro gallo cantará, que otro gallo cantará cuando lo libere al pobre el duende del carnaval, cuando lo libere al pobre el duende del carnaval. El pobre no callará, el pobre no callará, el mundo será más justo cuando llegue el carnaval, el mundo será más justo cuando llegue el carnaval. Días el diablo nos salvará, el diablo nos salvará con la revancha del pobre que es el rojo carnaval, con la revancha del pobre que es el rojo carnaval. Paisano, preste atención, que otro gallo cantará, que otro gallo cantará cuando lo libere al pobre el duende del carnaval, cuando lo libere al pobre. Carnaval. Sí, señor.
Hey, Fernando Cabral, in a selection of homeless tunes and chanties, Fagundo Cabral. Excuse me. And I don't know much more about it except tip of the hat to Skidmark Bob, who's looking pretty chipper these days. He's losing a lot of weight, getting tall, dark, and handsome. Boy, I don't know what to say. Those of you may remember Skidmark Bob, he still has a program every Tuesday, I believe, And I tell you, but the schedule has disappeared from the wall. You can find the schedule for Free Radio Santa Cruz at the website freakradio.org. So check it out if you're interested. And you can catch up on some of the cool shows. We've got new broadcasters coming in. I was really surprised the last Free Radio meeting. We had quite a number of folks. I'm used to seeing when I do, at the rare times I show up at these meetings, it's very sort of, there are small numbers of people there, but the more people that want to be supportive of us, the more you're going to hear, the better programs you're going to hear, the less technical interruptions, all that sort of stuff. And you probably know all that anyway, so why should I even mention it? So, I think what I want to do now is play something that I've been threatening to do, which is a little bit from the Victor Hugo novel Les Misérables, one of the largest, biggest, thickest novels. It's kind of the War and Peace-ish type size. And one of the most eloquent. I've been recently listening to it as I drive around town on my trusty CD player in my car, and I'm really impressed with its, stuff that I thought boring when I was a boy now seems to be very pertinent, very eloquent. It all happens around this particular section of the novel in June of 1832 when there was an insurrection. And that is something that Victor Hugo talks about, but he doesn't get into the specifics of the insurrection. He kind of has a heart for all sides in a way, although you sense a certain revolutionary sympathy listening to him, at least I do. But I'm going to play a bit of it and see if I can interest you, the listener. So listen on and tell me if you like it.
Book 10, June 5th, 1832. The issue on the surface. What makes a riot? Nothing and everything. Electricity released a little at a time. A flame suddenly shooting out. A roving force. A momentary breath of wind. This breath of wind meets beings that think, brains that dream, souls that suffer, passions that burn, howling torments, and carries them away. Where? Anywhere, willy-nilly. Regardless of the state, regardless of the laws, regardless of the prosperity and the insolence of others. Inflamed convictions, embittered enthusiasms, agitated indignations, warlike instincts held back, exalted young spirits, blindly generous impulses, curiosity, the taste for change, the thirst for the unexpected. The feeling that gives us pleasure reading the bill for a new show and makes us thrill to the whistle of the stagehand at the theater. Vague hatreds, resentments, disappointments, any vanity that feels that fate has failed them. Discontentments, hollow dreams, ambitions hedged in by high walls. Whoever hopes that collapse will provide a way out. Finally, at the very bottom, the peat bog, that mud that catches fire. These are the elements that make up a riot. The grandest and the most inconsequential. Beings who roam on the fringes, beyond the pale, waiting for an opportunity. Bohemians, vagrants, street corner vagabonds, those who sleep at night in urban deserts with no roof over their head but the cold clouds in the sky. Those who look to chance, not work, for their daily bread. Those unknown inhabitants of destitution and nothingness, the bare-armed, the barefoot, belong to the riot. Anyone who nurses in their soul a secret grudge against some act of the government, or of life, or fate, lives on the brink of riot, and as soon as it shows, begins to quiver and feel themselves lifted up by the vortex. The riot is a sort of whirlwind of the social atmosphere that forms, without warning, when the temperature reaches a certain level, and that rises as it swirls, runs, thunders, rips up, crushes, demolishes, uproots, dragging with it great natures and puny ones, manly men and the feeble-minded, the tree trunk and the wisp of straw. Woe to the one it carries away, as much as to the one it comes to strike. It smashes them against each other. It imparts to those it seizes some mysterious, extraordinary power. It fills the first comer with the force of events. It turns everything into projectiles. It turns a bit of rubble into a cannonball, and a street porter into a general. If you believe certain oracles of under-the-table politics, from the authorities' point of view, a bit of a riot is desirable. How it works in theory, a riot shores up those governments it fails to overthrow. It tests the army. It focuses the bourgeoisie. It flexes the muscles of the police. It gauges the strength of the social backbone. It is a gymnastic exercise. It is almost hygiene. The government feels better after a riot, like a man after a rubdown. 30 years ago, the riot was seen in a different light. For everything there is a theory that proclaims itself common sense. Filant versus Alceste, the offer of a compromise between the true and the false. Explanation, admonition, a somewhat arrogant mitigation that, because it is mixed with blame and excuse, believes itself to be wisdom yet is often only pedantry. An entire school of politics known as the happy medium has emerged from this. Between cold water and hot water, it is the party of lukewarm water. This school, whose pseudo-profundity is all on the surface, dissects effects without going back as far as causes, and rails against the tumult of the marketplace from the height of its pseudo-science. To hear this school? The riots muddied the waters in 1830 and robbed that great event of part of its purity. The July Revolution has been a beautiful, popular breath of fresh air, swiftly followed by blue skies. The riots brought the cloudy skies back. They made that revolution, initially so remarkable for its unanimity, degenerate into a brawl. In the July Revolution, as in all disjointed bouts of progress, there had been secret fractures. Rioting made these more marked. It became possible to say, ah, this is broken. After the July Revolution, all you had was a sense of liberation. After the riots, you sensed catastrophe. Any riot shuts the shops, depresses funds, upsets the stock exchange, suspends commerce, hampers business, speeds up bankruptcies. Money runs dry, private fortunes are thrown into turmoil, public credit is rattled, industry is thrown out of whack, capital withdraws, labor is underpaid, fear is everywhere. Aftershocks are triggered in all the towns, fissures then open into chasms. They reckon the first day of rioting costs France 20 million, the second 40, the third 60. A three-day riot costs 120 million. In other words, looking only at the financial result, it is equivalent to a disaster, a shipwreck or battle lost, one that wipes out a fleet of 60 ships of the line. Doubtless, historically, the riots had their beauty. The War of the Cobblestones is no less grandiose and no less pathetic than the War of the Bushes. In one lies the soul of the forest, in the other the heart of the city. One has Jean Chouan, the other has Jean. The riots lit up in red, garishly but splendidly, all the most prominent features of the Parisian character in its originality, generosity, devotion, stormy gaiety, with students proving that bravery plays a part in intelligence, the National Guard unshakable, the bivouacs of shopkeepers, the fortresses of street kids, the contempt for death of the average man in the street. Schools and legions clashed. After all, there was only a difference in age between the combatants. They are the same race. The same stoical men die at 20 for their ideas, at 40 for their families. The army, always sad in civil wars, pitted prudence against audacity. The riots, at the same time that they manifested the intrepidity of the people, were the making of bourgeois courage. That is all very well, but is all that worth the bloodshed? And to the bloodshed add the future darkened, progress compromised, anxiety among the best honest liberals despairing, foreign absolutism rubbing its hands with glee to see the revolution inflict such wounds on itself, the vanquished of 1830 triumphant and crowing, "We told you so." Add Paris made greater, perhaps, but France diminished for certain. Add, for we have to make a clean breast of it, the massacres that too often dishonored the victory of order turned ferocious, over liberty run amok. All in all, the riots have been catastrophic. Thus speaks that approximation of wisdom with which the bourgeoisie, that approximation of the people, contents itself so readily. As for us, we reject this too broad and consequently too convenient term, the riots. Between one popular movement and another popular movement, we make a distinction. We don't ask ourselves if a riot costs as much as a battle. For a start, why a battle? Here the question of war raises its ugly head. Is war less of a scourge than a riot is a calamity? And then, are all riots calamities? And what if the 14th of July did cost 20 million? The setting up of Philippe V in Spain cost France 2 billion. Even if the cost was the same, we prefer July 14th. Besides, we reject these figures that sound like arguments but are merely words. Given a riot, we look at it on its own. In all that the doctrinaire objection exposed above says, it is a question only of the effect. We look for the cause. We try to be specific. The heart of the matter. There is the riot, and there is the insurrection. They are two different forms of rage. One is wrong, the other is right. In democratic states, the only states based on justice, it sometimes happens that a fraction usurps power. Then all rise up, and the necessary vindication of rights can go as far as the taking up of arms. In all the issues that arise from collective sovereignty, the war of the whole against the fraction is an insurrection. The attack of the fraction against the whole is a riot. According to whether it is the king or the convention that is holed up in the Tuileries, they are justly or unjustly stormed. The same cannon turned on the hordes is wrong on August 10th and right on Vendémiaire 14. Similar in appearance, different at bottom. The Swiss guards defend the false. Bonaparte defends the true. What universal suffrage has done in all its liberty and its sovereignty cannot be undone by the street. The same goes for the things of civilization, pure and simple. The instinct of the masses, yesterday clear-sighted, may be cloudy tomorrow. The same fury is legitimate against Terray and absurd against Turgot. The smashing of machines, the pillaging of warehouses, the tearing up of railway lines, the demolition of docks, the wrong turns taken by the multitudes, the people's denials of justice for progress, Lamuse assassinated by schoolboys, Rousseau driven out of Switzerland, pelted with stones, that is rioting. Israel versus Moses, Athens versus Phocion, Rome versus Scipio, that is rioting. Paris versus the Bastille is insurrection. The soldiers versus Alexander, the sailors versus Christopher Columbus, it is the same revolt, an ungodly revolt. Why? Because Alexander does for Asia with the sword what Christopher Columbus does for America with the compass. Alexander, like Columbus, discovers a world. These gifts of a world to civilization are such increments of light that any resistance to them is criminal. Sometimes the people twist fidelity to themselves. The mob is a traitor to the people. Is there anything more peculiar, for instance, than that long and bloody protest of the contraband salt makers, a chronic legitimate revolt which at the decisive moment, on the day of salvation, at the hour of popular victory, suddenly takes up the cause of the throne, turns into the Chouan uprising, and goes from being an insurrection against to a riot for? Grim masterpieces of ignorance. The contraband saltmaker escapes the royal gallows and, with a remnant of rope still around his neck, sports the white cockade. Death to the salt taxes gives birth to Long Live the King. The St. Bartholomew killers, September cutthroats, Avignon slaughterers, assassins of Coligny, assassins of Madame de Lambert, assassins of Brune, Miquelet militia, followers of Verdet, cadonnet-wearing soldiers, companions of Jesus, the Chevalier du Brossard, that is riot for you. La Vendée is one big Catholic riot. The sound of justice in motion is recognizable, and it doesn't always come from the quaking of the overburdened masses. There are crazy rages, there are cracked bells. Not all toxins ring out with the sound of bronze. The surging motion of passion and ignorance is not the same as the jolt of progress. Rise up by all means, but only to grow. Show me where you are going. Insurrection can only ever forge ahead. Any other uprising is bad. Any violent step backward is riot. To recoil is an act of assault and battery against the human race. Insurrection is the truth's fit of fury. The cobblestones that the insurrection tears up throw off the spark of justice. These cobblestones leave riot only their mud. Danton versus Louis XVI is an insurrection. Hébert versus Danton is a riot. This is why, in given cases, an insurrection may be, as Lafayette claims, the most sacred of duties, but a riot may be the most deadly of violent attacks. There is also some difference in the intensity of heat given off. An insurrection is often a volcano. A riot is often a flash in the pan. Revolt, as we have said, sometimes occurs within the powers that be. Polignac is a rioter. Camille Desmoulins is a ruler. Sometimes insurrection is resurrection. The solving of everything by universal suffrage being an entirely modern development, and all history prior to this development being filled for 4,000 years with the violated rights and suffering of peoples, each era of history brings with it what protest is thinkable to it. Under the Caesars, there was no insurrection. But there was Juvenal. The facit indignatio, anger, rights, poetry, replaces the Gracchi. Under the Caesars, there is the Saini exile. There is also the man of the annals. We say nothing of the mighty exile of Patmos, who too shatters the real world with a protest in the name of the ideal world, turns vision into an enormous satire, and casts over Rome-Nineveh, over Rome-Babylon, over Rome-Sodom, the flaming reflection of the apocalypse. John on his rock is the Sphinx on its pedestal. We may not understand him. He is a Jew, and it is all in Hebrew, but the man who writes the annals is a Latin, better still, a Roman. Since the Neros reign so blackly, they should be depicted accordingly. The work of the engraver's Burin on its own would be too pale. We need to pour concentrated prose that bites into the engraved lines. Despots have a hand in creating thinkers. Shackled words are terrible words. The writer doubly, triply intensifies his style when silence is imposed on the people by some master. A certain mysterious fullness swells up out of this silence, and it filters thought and turns it to stone. Clamping down in history produces concision in the historian. The rock-solid compactness of whatever celebrated prose is nothing more than a tamping down by the tyrant. Tyranny forces the writer to make cuts in diameter that are incremental increases in strength. The Ciceronian period, barely adequate on the subject of Verres, would lose its edge on Caligula. Less scope in the phrase, more intensity in the punch.
And I guess that one went on a little too long. The discussion of insurrection versus riot is really what interested me, and there is more of it. And it's interesting and very specific. A lot of the references are so erudite and actually sort of 150 years old that it's hard to follow them. But there's a passion to Victor Hugo writing about, he's writing from his vantage point of the 1860s about things that happened 30 or 40 years before, but he writes with a real passion and sympathy for people who rose up to defend the rights of everyone. And though in this country we don't have the armed insurrection, and nor am I suggesting it's time for such a thing either, there is an understanding that there is a time for such a thing. And that's, of course, a matter of great discussion and debate among people concerned who believe very sincerely and very strongly that that nonviolence is not only a tactic, but it is a sort of a, must be a way of life, must be a fundamental commitment, that it's there's never really a time for any kind of insurrection or violence. And I've spent some time on this program at different points discussing this and presenting people's different points of view on this. To me, it's a touchy subject even to think about or talk about because of my own liberal upbringing myself, and also as a broadcaster and a public figure, and as a target of the government these days, it feels risky to talk about these issues, even though it's important that we be able to discuss them openly and understand what the implications of them are from all points of view, and what the best course of action to follow is in any situation. And that's perhaps something you can't really discuss as publicly as you might want to, but I always strive for that and will continue to do so. You are tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM. Actually, we are hoping to get back at 101.3. We're also streaming. If you go to tunein.org or kind of browse around for that, you'll be able to find Free Radio Santa Cruz's stream there, I believe. That's one of the places it's there. We didn't put it there, I don't think, but somebody may have, and that's the place to go, or at least one of the places to go to find it. So I'm going to be playing some more tape of a more local nature and less arcane and less ancient. So don't give up hope because I've thrown Victor Hugo at you, probably a bit too much of him. I'm looking now at an interesting article from Ashland, Oregon, which I want to read. It's an article in the Ashland Daily Tidings. Sleep disorder. Despite repeated citations, a homeless man refuses to take the camping ban lying down. And there's a picture of a guy standing next to a bench with a sleeping bag and a mat. Sort of a little like our very own Gary Johnson, who did this at the courthouse and got sentenced to 2 years in jail for his trouble, although he's out, the sentence was suspended, and he's still fighting a six-month suspended sentence, or sorry, a six-month sentence that hasn't been suspended, but that is pending if he loses the case, as is Ed Fry, his attorney, who also not only went into court with him, but slept outside with him in a protest against the laws that criminalize homeless people here in our city. In Santa Cruz, say that you can't do what everyone has to do at night, sleep after 11 o'clock at night. It's actually a literal crime under Don Lane's laws, the code, the sleeping ban law, which he's never voted against in his long political career. Here's the story from the Ashland Tidings. A homeless man who says he's willing to get arrested repeatedly in order to shine a spotlight on what he considers unfair city ordinances against camping in public places in Ashland. Keith Haxton, 23, who came to Ashland 2 years ago, started spending his nights sleeping on a bench in the plaza on Monday. The first night he was cited three times by three different police officers for prohibited sleeping on benches. And the same thing happened, not three times, but four times to Gary, although it wasn't Gary Johnson. It wasn't all in one night. I think it was on a succession of nights. I could sleep somewhere else. I could go in a back alleyway. I could go try to hide and sleep and maybe be ticketed, Haxton said late Tuesday night, but I'm here because it shouldn't be something that we have to hide. There's a problem with the law, and it needs to be shown so people can fix it. Tuesday night he wasn't cited, but on Wednesday night he was transported to jail, where he remained late Thursday on a charge of interfering with a police officer, a Class A misdemeanor. The charge covers someone who refuses to obey a lawful order by an officer. So it sounds like it's just the same thing. You can't sleep here, and him saying, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And that suddenly becomes an even worse misdemeanor because you're doing what an officer says you shouldn't do. This, of course, is the very essence of the police state, the notion that the police officer's orders should be something you have to obey, even when they're absurd, unconstitutional, abusive, and actually a form of torture and a violation of human rights. All, of course, is a matter of everyday course in Santa Cruz, everyday course in Ashland, Oregon. But some people are saying no, both in Santa Cruz and in Ashland. The charge covers someone, as I said before, refuses to obey a lawful order by an officer. His bail was listed at $4,000. And I think Gary's bail here was $5,000. So, Ashlyn, it's a little cheaper for you if you are in jail for sleeping. Haxton moved to Ashlyn from Florida and worked as a teacher's aide at Ashlyn High School. He attended classes at Rogue Community College and Southern Oregon University before running out of financial aid, he said. When he became homeless in April 2011, he started sleeping in his car. But he soon found out he would be breaking the law if police observed him camping within city limits. City codes prohibit camping on any publicly owned property and sleeping on benches or within doorways between the hours of 9 p.m. and 8 a.m. Actually, I think I did read this story before, but it bears a second reading. Our sleeping ban is from 11 p.m. to 8:30 a.m. When I first became homeless, I was looking for a job for 3 months, really looking and filling out resumes all over the place, said Haxton. Over the winter, I've become involved in changing the way things are. Sounds like maybe an Occupy movement, but don't know. I had friends that were really generous to me and let me crash on their couch or floor, and now it's gotten to a point where even my friends are struggling. Haxton said he's been going to working groups and meetings with other local people who are interested in helping out the poor and people without shelter. He read Decriminalizing Poverty, Reform of Ashland's Camping Ordinance, written by Paul Moss, David Berger, and Ralph Temple of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon in October 2008. But that our American Civil Liberties Union here in Santa Cruz would have the courage to even say we don't like the sleeping ban, which so far, in spite of repeated appeals over the last 20 years, refused to do. It kind of gave me a legal reference and an argument to think about this issue of camping prohibited, said Haxton. I've been advocating and organizing and doing everything I could. I went to the city council in November of last year and said your camping ordinance is unconstitutional because you're denying a person the right to sleep, and sleeping is a human necessity. Haxton was one of the organizers of Occupy Ashland. Ah, there it is. Last fall, when protesters occupied the plaza for 22 consecutive days and nights. Haxton is particularly concerned about a prolonged exclusion zone, or a proposed exclusion zone, that would bar repeat offenders from downtown temporarily. Those who ventured back before the time limit could be arrested on a charge of trespassing and taken to jail. That's one of the 22 charges leveled against me and 11 others, as members of Santa Cruz 11. Although, as I said, charges against four have been dismissed, and two of those are likely to be free of all charges for the indefinite future. Unless, of course, the DA decides to try anyway, which Rebecca Young has shown she's interested in doing. Continuing with the Ashland article, it would step up enforcement for a law that was already wrong to begin with, he said. Ashland Police Chief Terry Holderness is working out the details of the proposal, which he will bring to the City Council for consideration. Each of Haxton's citations carries a $250 fine, said Sergeant Jim Alderman. It's a task on our resources, said Alderman. We have to decide how long we let this go on. Whereas staying awake all night isn't a problem for ordinary poor people, I guess, is the unspoken subtext. Councilman Greg Lemhouse said he wouldn't comment on the exclusion zone until the details were determined. When we set up the homeless task force about a year ago, I made the motion to table the exclusionary zone issue because I wanted to see some issues come forward, and we didn't have any proposals come forward, he said. It's something that I'd rather get right than rush. Groups such as the Homeless Steering Committee and the Ashland Homeless Coalition have offered ideas, said Councilwoman Carol Voisin, a former liaison to the steering committee. We have tons of ideas, said Voisin. The Homeless Steering Committee was given a proposal by the Salvation Army where they would have a day center set up with a thrift shop that the city would help with rent, and the council said no. We wanted the Grove to be open for additional hours for showers, and they said no. The council voted against showers at the Grove because of safety and liability concerns and because members thought such an operation should be run by an experienced organization. It also declined to give the Salvation Army $24,000 it requested to run a day center, saying funding should be decided when the city awards social and housing services grants. The Ashland Homeless Coalition is hoping to find developers for transitional housing that would provide skills to those in need so they could find work and transition into affordable housing, said Voisin. It seems no matter what you bring, there is a higher level that they, the city council members, expect every time you bring it to them, said Voisin. You have to start dealing with the problem. You can't keep pushing it away by having a higher threshold of what you want. Haxton believes the city should provide a shelter for those who need it, amend the anti-camping ordinance, or just strike it down and come up with a different approach to this. That's something the city council of Santa Cruz obviously should do as well, but won't. Really, the approach that the city council has been taking is off in the wrong direction, he said. It's very hostile towards those with low income or low means. Haxton plans on continuing his civil disobedience by sleeping in the plaza, but he's concerned that an exclusionary zone might pass within the next month while he is still protesting. I'm willing to accept whatever punishment they give me, he said. There is a quote I keep in mind. The point of civil disobedience is to make injustice visible. And if you're going to throw someone in the prison for trying to sleep, I hope that makes it visible to people. That's my intention, is to make people look at that and examine what's going on in their society when that's happening. And that's an article in the Ashton Daily Tidings up in Oregon. Sleep disorder despite repeated citations. Homeless man Keith Haxton refuses to take the camping ban lying down. And here's another article from Ashland, a community forum article. Again, looks like from the Daily Tidings, which I suspect is their newspaper there. Might be an alternative paper. Ashland's homeless problem, and again, this article is also written by Anna Guzik. Ashland's homeless problem could be solved by lifting the city's camping ban, creating shelters, building a campground, or having landowners adopt campers. Attendees at Southern Oregon University's town hall meeting on homelessness said Thursday. And those suggestions have all been put forward here in Santa Cruz and ignored by the Santa Cruz City Council. Homeless residents and Ashland City officials, including Mayor John Stromberg and City Councilwoman Carol Voisin, discussed the possible solutions with students and community members at the evening meeting. As a society, we have a big investment in keeping people from falling into homelessness, and we have a big investment in giving people ladders and ways out of homelessness, Stromberg said. Voisin, an SOU ethics professor, said there are 83 homeless children and more than 200 homeless adults in Ashland. We have 1,500 to 2,000 in our city, who are primarily young men, according to the school district data and the Vincent DePaul charity. Somewhere along the line, we failed them, she said. Aaron Fletcher, who is homeless, suggested that the community come together to solve the problem instead of relying on the government. He asked audience members to consider adopting a homeless person by signing a card that would allow the homeless person to camp on their property between certain hours in exchange for about 30 minutes of yard work each day. This way we can integrate homeless people into our community instead of segmenting them to the side, he said. American Civil Liberties Union lawyer Ralph Temple said the city's camping ban is unjust and should be lifted until the city builds a shelter for the homeless. And, of course, American Civil Liberties lawyer in Santa Cruz, Don Zimmerman, who I don't think he's around much anymore, but he was 5 or 6 years ago when the camping ban was ruled in Los Angeles to be cruel and unusual punishment in the Jones decision, had nothing to say about the camping ordinance. He wouldn't make a statement, nor would the ACLU. Nor is the ACLU doing so now. I had a conversation with an activist earlier today because the ACLU apparently is offering us memberships, scholarships, according to Steve Plaich, who's on their board of directors. And the issue has come up, should people join the ACLU so they can reform it from within? Because after all, the ACLU does seem to have taken a different stance on the Santa Cruz 11. They've denounced the proceedings, or they've suggested that there's some serious problems with the prosecution of the Santa Cruz 11. I don't think they have the temerity to come out and outrightly say dismiss the charges, which of course is what they should do. But they have at least suggested the charges are overcharged, and there are a lot of civil liberties problems with them. So maybe the ACLU is taking a turn for the better, a turn toward actual local civil liberties. And my thought about that, though, on second thought, was, well, once a number of organizations get behind a group of people who are, some of them, quite middle class in the sense that they're not homeless, they're not as poor as folks who are homeless and outside, then And there are other organizations of reporters have come out with statements denouncing these prosecutions. Then the ACLU is willing to jump in front of the parade. And I guess in a way, I've been told by other activists, this is what liberals do. This is what politicians do. They will not do stuff themselves. You have to create the mass movement, and then they will deign to, walk at the head of the parade as though they'd been there all along. Which to me, of course, is kind of disgusting, actually. And it's also misleading to people around, because if they're willing to do that, then if a bunch of people, if other interest groups can support the opposite, support repression, more police activity, they'll jump in front of that one too. Although it doesn't even have to be a parade with politicians in power, because of the insulated and lack of transparency that we see, you have politicians who are fundamentally at the beck and call of special interest groups that support war, that support police repression and violence, that support massive corruption and environmental devastation. And it's not likely to change through the current political system. At least that's what a lot of us feel. Continuing with this article, though, I guess I paused to talk about the American Civil Liberties Union locally, and it's a real quandary for me. I'm glad to see the ACLU coming out on this one issue around it's attacks on Occupy Santa Cruz, but it's more specifically the 11 people who have been falsely arrested and dragged into court for this peaceful occupation, essentially by other people, of a building at the 75 River Street. Last year. So I'm glad that the ACLU is involved in that. The question is, should we actually be hopeful that by joining the ACLU, people can change the ACLU to take on the issues that they've been ignoring? Criminalization of homeless people downtown, racial prejudice and profiling, abusive police behaviors generally, lack of police oversight, lack of transparency of public officials, curfews and exclusionary measures in public spaces, all these things, which at least some of these issues have been taken up by ACLU organizations in other areas, but not here in Santa Cruz. Will that, is there a sufficient reason for believing this will be taken up? I think what I may do is call Steve Plaich, who is actually on the board of directors of the ACLU, and he's actually leading this campaign. Give him a chance to make a pitch to all you folks out there. Let's see if we can catch him on the... whoops, that didn't work. Let's try again. Steve Plaich, just a moment. Steve... I'm having phone problems, folks, but I will try one more time. Maybe we can actually do this. Let's see. I think we have him now. Or we hope.
I'm back.
Steve Plaich, sorry about the delay and confusion here, but you are on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so make the most of it with your apparently, we're not talking so much about your new city council bid, I should say your old and continuing city council bid, but the American Civil Liberties Union that you are now encouraging people to join, is that right?
Absolutely. We're offering some kind of scholarships or fees paid for folks who want to kind of resume their interest in the ACLU. We think we're going to be able to move forward with some issues in town. And as you know, we're in support of the Santa Cruz 11. We're engaged on the FCOM issues. So at some point, you never know, we might even take a look at downtown ordinances and the sleeping bans. So the more folks we get who are interested in that kind of thing, the more likely that will happen.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question that I've been kind of raising on the air, and I talked about it with another activist today about whether there's any point in having anything to do with the ACLU. I've often kind of poo-pooed Bob LaMonica's attempts to get you guys roused up. And by you guys, I want to really actually separate you from the great majority of ACLU board members and ACLU activists or non-activists or inactivists, because you are prominently an activist, not so much because you're on the board, but because you're around town making connection with a lot of different people and a lot of different causes, and have been prominently involved in Occupy Santa Cruz as well.
Well, that's true, and you know, I think it's a way to at least try to engage ACLU. I mean, I think Bob made some very valid points when he appeared to the board, as he often does, and chides us for not having been engaged over the years in more issues of local interest, and I think to a certain extent he's right. And maybe that kind of reminder that we should be more engaged is part of the reason why they engaged so quickly. And in fact, by unanimous vote in support of the Santa Cruz 11 and the selective prosecutions and the, we feel, political nature of those prosecutions, and also engaging as fully as we have on kind of the ESCOM issues, stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, some would say, you know, Bob has his objections to our actions are not well taken. I, on the other hand, think that every time we've heard from him, you know, it's done something to kind of move us forward, you know, if grudgingly and haltingly, at least it's somewhat forward.
Well, at Bob's request, and perhaps your request, I'm not sure if you actually did request it at the time, but I've been to two or three ACLU board meetings in the last year, and at the request of Peter, what's his name, the co-director?
Peter Gelbaum, who's the chair.
Yeah, yeah. Or Jen Laskin, who is also, she's now co-chair, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm, vice chair.
You know, I put forward very specific proposals, 10 different things the ACLU could do, which didn't involve spending any money, didn't involve, you know, getting a lawyer involved, but simply involved, I mean, such obvious things as defending their own members who are trying to petition in the parking lot of Trader Joe's, which has now banned all solicitors from the parking lot. And, you know, I couldn't even get a coherent response from any member of your board, yourself included, Steve, on that issue or any other issue, which I raised. And there were 10 different issues. So my thought was, and I'm not saying you won't change your mind in the future, but my thought was, what should people who have seen how, you know, hollow the ACLU has been in the past, what should really encourage them other than these two things, which I agree are good things, you know, the people standing up for the rights of immigrants to be able to be free from this abusive federal bullshit that's being colluded with by the sheriff, WOAC, you know, when they're picked up, what do you call it, the ESCOM thing, right?
Yeah, it's the Secure Communities Program.
You know, I mean, I think that's certainly a positive thing, but, you know, the thing that was said by the other activists I spoke to, who may be speaking tomorrow at the Santa Cruz 11 for the 11th at the Trader Joe's, mm-hmm. at India Joe's, at 3 o'clock. I invite people to come on down. Is what she was telling me was, you know, the ACLU is not going to do anything on these other local issues until there is a mass movement that they can jump in front of and wave the flag for. And I said, well, look, Steve Plaich is working hard there inside to get some things done, although not apparently on the 10 issues that I've raised in any particular way. But, you know, I'm not sure, you know, what to do. I mean, you were giving out pins last night. I took one of your pins. I thought,
yeah, there you go. Everybody took the pin.
I mean, I normally wear a pin with ACLU, as I've told you, with a line through it, which says, you know, stay away from this group. It's poison.
Yeah,
and I say
yeah.
the same thing to Bob LaMonica. If you want civil liberties, form your own group. Organize people who really want to do civil liberties, not those who are interested in blocking it or fundraising for their 2,000 members or whatever.
And that's all true enough, but I haven't seen any movement toward forming any kind of an organization or a group of folks who are even interested in, you know, putting forth the civil liberties, concerns about downtown ordinances and the camping ban, things like that. You know, if Bob LaMonica wants to do it, if you want to do it, if there are other folks around with whom you may have spoken earlier, then get together and form a group and do it. You know, I'm all for that. Mm-hmm. Any movement toward that has my support. The group that I'm working with, the ACLU, Santa Cruz County, that's the one that I'm trying to move forward on this issue. You know, whoever gets there first is a winner, but the real winners are the people who are being targeted by downtown ordinances and camping bans. So, you know, everybody's got to do their part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess wondering what part the ACLU is likely to take in the next year. I guess really, since you're the one of the most active people in the ACLU around these issues, are you interested in giving some of your time? Because now it's going to be taken up a lot with running for city council and talking about a variety of issues, not just civil liberties issues, but all kinds of issues. Or is your campaign going to focus more narrowly on certain civil liberties type issues?
No, the fact that I'm running for city council doesn't mean that I'm going to abandon any of the other issues in my involvement with things like the Santa Cruz 11 or things like ESCOM or things like, for instance, you know, looking at the downtown ordinance and the camping ban. You know, those kinds of things, as long as I'm involved with the ACLU and it commands a certain amount of my time, even during a campaign, I'm going to see what I can do to work to bring some focus to that.
Yeah, I just know that for the last year, and you've been, I mean, the group that's brought focus to these things, not so much through appealing to the ACLU or trying to join the ACLU or even criticizing the ACLU, has been Occupy Santa Cruz, which has just been out there saying, in essence, we will assert our constitutional rights, although, admittedly, a lot of folks have been driven away, and that, you know, the occupation essentially died in December as an ongoing occupation. Still, people met last night, even you, you know, as city council member may have been in violation of the curfew around the courthouse.
Imagine that. You know, Occupy Santa Cruz is a terrific vehicle for, you know, activist movement in terms of challenging the downtown ordinances and the camping ban, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you can get those people focused and galvanized into some kind of action, then, you know, I'm there with them. And I think everybody who has any concerns about these, you know, the repressive ordinances that we have, would be interested in participating. But it's all about how many people you're going to get out in the streets, how much of an effect you're going to have, what are you going to do, how are you going to direct it. You know, I mean, advocate, but direct action, being out in the streets, is a way to challenge it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've noticed. Of course, it's direct action is much easier when you have larger numbers of people to do it.
Of course, critical mass is all about.
Yeah, for sure. And for those who are carrying on a loan struggle, and you've been one of those, you know, in the ACLU, again, not on the issues that I've raised, but on other issues, you know, good issues. I mean, you're supporting me and urging that charges against me and all the rest of Santa Cruz 11 be dropped.
Yeah.
You know, I can hardly say without biting the hand that feeds me, you know, that this is not. But, you know, you understand my point, that we've really briefed and argued many issues before the ACLU. You're suggesting this can now be a legitimate kind of these. Do you have the time and energy to raise any of these issues specifically, or are you likely to do what you've done for the last year, which is
well, tell you that I would have more time, more energy to do it if I thought I had more support. And, you know, if I can do it as one lone voice on the board, then that's not as effective as if, you know, we had many people from Occupy or many people that were offering to, you know, pay their fees and get on board with the ACLU and come to the meetings, or at least, you know, write to the vice chair and the chair and really make their voices heard. Maybe that makes a difference.
Mm. So what is the fee normally that is being waived by ACLU?
I think the minimum is, which I pay, is like $20 a year.
And so there are how many are scholarships available for anyone who wants them? Or?
Yeah, I have probably about 30 or 40 of them, I think. We were going to put a ceiling, I guess, the amount on that, because actually the money the state comes out of our treasury. But fortunately for us, Santa Cruz County ACLU is one of the best funded ACLU chapters in the state, so in the country for that matter. So there is some money to be spent on that, and they agreed to fund those new, you know, memberships, because they want new members. You know, they want new voices, and I do. I don't know whether anybody else does, frankly, but I do. So, you know, that's where I'm coming from.
One also wonders, I mean, forgive me, the rationale for this. I mean, all organizations have a bureaucratic tendency to want to, like huge beasts, get bigger, you know, and get more support and more financial background. I saw 2,000 people with the ACLU having absolutely no interest whatsoever in poor people in Santa Cruz. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, what is the impetus likely to be, you know, is it probably the impulse is simply to get a larger organization that's better funded, right? I mean,
well, you know, yeah, all I can do is point to, you know, the Santa Cruz 11 website, and there's, you know, 1,200 people have signed a petition in support of the ACLU statement that it supports Santa Cruz 11. And so there are probably thousands of those people who have never been involved with the ACLU in their lives, didn't know, you know, what it did or, you know, who was representing what position. But they've been willing to go on there and read an ACLU petition on the ACLU letterhead and sign that in support of what we believe is a very important cause in Santa Cruz. So we're linked to that, and people who are linked to that also are linked to the ACLU, maybe for the first time. So it's just, you know, a new beginning for people who are at least aware of the ACLU, and we'll see what happens.
I guess that's the question. Is it a new beginning, or is it simply they jumped in front of the latest bandwagon and they're going forward because of the commendable and very, you know, strong organizing activity done by you and a few other people who are not the normal ACLU board members or even the ACLU members. I mean, you know, that I don't think that the ACLU has had much to do with that petition that got put forward. You are the person who cooked it up. You put it before them, and they endorsed it.
And I would agree, but on the other hand, I haven't heard one ACLU member in Santa Cruz County is sending us an angry email or an angry letter or an angry phone call saying, I don't support the Santa Cruz 11. What are you doing? What are you talking about? These people are criminals and should be prosecuted for the law. I haven't heard one person.
I bet you'll find lots of angry people if you stand up and support any of the other actual civil liberties violations of ordinary poor people in Santa Cruz.
We'll find that out when we do stand up.
Well, I'd like to see you do some of that, Steve. I'd like to, if you do want to do the same thing with any of those other 10 issues, that would be great. Though I hear what you're saying. You need to feel there is support out there to help you do that and to, you know, to give you some background for doing that. So I say right on. Any updates? I know you're with the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project, Needle Exchange, Suicide Prevention, D-Cell. Any updates for us here?
Well, we're still working on the D-Cell petition. We'll be having a meeting on Monday to kind of see where we are in the signature gathering campaign. We need about 6,000 signatures of registered voters to put the charter amendment on the ballot. So we'll see how that's going. But actually, tomorrow's a busy day because, as you know, we will all be over in Port of Bradley and Alex and their motion to dismiss. And then after that, I have the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project from 1 to 3 at the Homeless Services Center. And then we're having the Save the 11th for the 11, and then there's, you know, the Women in Black, and you know, to stand with them for a while. So always something going on, as you well know.
Uh-huh. Any events coming up this weekend that you want to suggest people might pay some attention to?
Oh, really, not for me, because I'm going to be all day long doing a suicide prevention training. That's a full Saturday, and then I have a shift from 6 to 10 on Saturday. That's going to take all my stuff.
How long have you been with suicide prevention now?
I graduated from my training in the fall of 2008, so it's coming up on about 3.5 years or so.
Have you seen much of a rise, fall, decline, or you know whatever in the suicide rate here, or the effectiveness of the work you're doing?
Well, I think it's always effective, but I think it's steady. We get about 4,800 calls a year, but certainly all those aren't suicide calls. Many of them are just people in crisis, people having, you know, problems with relationships or dysfunctional families, and you know, just people unhappy about various things. And there are a lot of folks like that around. So you know, we just listen to people and you know, try to be supportive as we possibly can. But I haven't really noticed statistics. I don't follow, except to know that we've had about the same number of calls every year since I've been affiliated with the group, which is about 4,800. So we get about 400 a month. So we always get calls. We're always there.
How about the needle exchange situation? Has there been much of a change either in the need for services or the availability of services in the last 4 years?
Well, actually, we have expanded our services because now we have people who are trained to do HIV and HCV, hep C testing on our exchange sites. We have home delivery. We have 3 outreach sites during each week. So we're exchanging probably this year about 230,000 clean syringes for dirty contaminated syringes that might otherwise end up in the, you know, in the gutters and the beaches and the parks and places like that. So our services are constantly expanding, and we might even at some point get into some counseling about rehab and things like that. So we're always interested in trying to support the intravenous drug user community in ways that are going to be kind of transitional for them if we can. We're not telling anybody they shouldn't be living their lifestyle, but we're trying to make it a lot safer for everybody else.
Hmm. Any truth to the rumors that there's corruption going on and layoffs over at the Homeless Lack of Services Center in terms of financial problems over there that you know of?
Well, as you know, Leticia Schwartz, who is the assistant executive director, in fact was the interim executive director just before Monica Martinez was hired, and Daniel White have both left the Homeless Services Center, and their replacements have not been found as yet, so I think their duties are kind of being spread out amongst the folks who are still there. Why they left, I haven't really been able to determine, frankly, but I know that it was kind of sudden departure, but that's not unusual in a lot of nonprofit agencies. Some days that people are there, some days for some reason they're not. Sometimes it has something to do with financial, sometimes people are just moving on into other opportunities. So,
Daniel...
I know that they are not there and they haven't been replaced yet.
So this is Daniel White and what, Nancy Lou Biscotti?
Pardon me?
Who is the other person who's left?
No, Leticia Schwartz.
Oh, Leticia, yeah.
She
hasn't really been a hands-on person so much, right?
Well, she was working with Page Smith Community House quite a bit, and I think since Monica's been on board, Leticia's role has been more focused on Page Smith and maybe some other supervisory responsibilities, but she's moved on, as has Daniel, so...
You're also a person who gets you've been doing a lot of work with birth certificates, kind of stemming from your attempt to get people, homeless people and others, birth certificates who need them, right?
Oh, brother, have I. I just finally caught up with some of the applications. I probably took about 30 or so applications or more at the recent Homeless Connect, and so a lot of that's been getting the fill out, you know, the form, the request, and then you have to get a picture ID, and then it has to be mailed, and it's, a lot of it is just really clerical, but you have to kind of stay on it day to day, and I just kind of caught up a little bit with it today, and I'll probably not do any of that over the weekend, so I have other things to do, but then I'll kind of re-engage on Monday and see if we can get people some identification.
Much in the way of, I've been hearing more about homeless citations for sleeping, as well as, of course, the downtown ordinance stuff. Are you been getting into any of that?
I have talked to a couple or two or three people that I'm in regular contact with, the folks downtown that I do some kind of consistent legal work for, and they've been saying that they have received more tickets here recently, but I think that the people that are talking to me just receive tickets quite a bit because they're always sleeping out in places that the cops notice. So for some reason or other, it's not unusual for them, but there is a seemingly a small spike in camping van citations. But it could just be anecdotal. I really don't know. I'd probably have to talk to more people and find out if there's any real change. You know, I don't think there's any policy shift, frankly, but, you know, there are things happen.
Have you been able successfully to fight any of the citations for these absurd downtown ordinances or the sleeping ban in the last year?
I haven't because usually when I get the tickets, I talk to the folks, I go maybe to court with them to see if they get a court date, and either the folks that I have been talking to have either moved on and really never went to court on it, or for some reason those tickets were dismissed at some point before they got to court. So as you know, that's all, we've been trying to track that in the last year or so, and it's all been really murky. We don't know exactly whether, you know, the city attorney is still dismissing tickets, whether or not they're still consulting the waiting list or the Homeless Services Center, whether or not Bob Lee mentioned at Project Connect that he wants to do something to get tickets dismissed before they reach the courtroom stage because it's just for administrative purposes. So
he's our district attorney.
I think it's really in a state of flux, kind of, and when I have the time to kind of look at it a little more and gather more information, maybe we'll get some kind of coherent policy out of the police and the city attorney and the DA. But right now it's just, you know, I don't really grasp, you know, exactly what's going on, but I'm certain at some point we will.
Any truth to the rumor that Zach Friend is going to be your prime endorser and campaign funder in your city council campaign?
Well, you know, Zach and I have been very close ever since the 75 that we shoot out the station, but no, probably not. He's busy running for supervisor in District 2 out there in Aptos. So.
Folks should know that I'm, of course, being somewhat sarcastic here. You and Zach, you had some rather harsh words to say about old Zach at one point, I think.
Well, we kind of agree to disagree about how that whole situation over there should have been or could have been handled, but, you know, that's just the way it goes. And,
he is, of course, a police PR guy who's now running for, what, the third supervisorial?
That's the second supervisorial, and Aptos, so Alan Fury is stepping down, and she's already endorsed Zach, so I don't know that he has any real opposition out there.
This could be an opportunity for you to step up there, Steve.
Well, if I lived in Aptos, so if I could switch my residency, maybe I'll just move my motorhome out there.
Truth. You're exposing yourself again there, Steve Plage.
There you go. Anyway, I got to move on here.
Hey, thanks again. And, Steve, if you want to be reached, I take it you're still at 466-6078.
I sure am.
And I'll be downtown at the secret rendezvous point across from New Leaf Market in case you wish to get together afterward.
I may drop by.
All right.
Talk to you soon.
Take care. And actually, that's Joe's Pizza, where I occasionally wander in and chow down on their tasty food. This is not a paid commercial, by the way, because just a statement of my preferences. Well, I have about 10 minutes left in the show here. I'm going to play a little bit now from an earlier protest that was quite successful in the sense that people showed up, but unsuccessful in the sense that the Obama regime, or Führer Obama, as I like to call him, is continuing to stand by the National War Authorization Act. They call it the National Defense Authorization Act or Appropriations Act. That's the one that, you know, gives him the very, that actually sort of puts the, puts on paper what has been the policy all along, that if he wants to remove your civil rights by having you put into a detention camp as a, what was the word, Bush would call you an enemy combatant, he would call you a privileged enemy belligerent, I guess is the new terminology. But whatever the terminology, you know, you still get the thrill of being isolated from the community for an indefinite period and not having access to lawyers or the civil process or reading of the charges or freedom from torture. All that stuff, of course, you don't get with either the Bush or the Obama regime. So either the Democrats or the Republicans, you're stuck with the same stuff. And here's the protest that actually happened at the beginning of April, I believe, where folks sort of, it might have even been the beginning of March, but people here didn't like it, I didn't like it, I hope you don't like it, and maybe together we'll find some way to reverse it and come to a better conclusion.
So it's now about 4:10. 4:15. This car drives by the protest, which is about 30 people in front of the town clock. It's today is the it's the Occupy protest. It's about today's March 3rd. Hey there, Daniel. We have the right to trial, a core U.S. value. Oh, this is so, Daniel. What is this protest about?
It's about repealing the NDAA,
which is
the National Defense Authorization Act.
Don't you want national defense?
Well, it's not really about the NDAA. It's about a provision within the NDAA, which grants
1021 and 1022, perhaps.
Perhaps.
And what are those provisions, and why should we be concerned?
Oh, here, a lot more. You take over that. It's basically gives the government the ability to detain someone without due process if they deem them a terrorist or a threat to the nation, I suppose you could say.
Do you trust your president? He shakes his head. Gentlemen, let this be known. He shakes his head.
We'll just leave it at that.
And we've been talking with
Danonymous.
Danonymous. Thank you, Danonymous. We have a press man and a man visiting from San Jose. First of all, hello there, press man.
Hi.
So you have your press credentials with you. This will not shield you from conspiracy charges.
Well, you like these. These are the official Indie Bay press passes.
I like those. I'd like one myself. Make me one.
One of a kind, huh?
Oh, yeah.
It won't be issued again for a year from now, so.
Oh, boy.
These fancy ones.
Out of luck, man. It looks like I have to go for the plain and simple ones.
You got to communicate, Robert. You got to communicate. You got to be a team player.
I got to be a team player. That's going to be a little harder.
I'm just trying to scare you.
Yeah, well, things are scaring me these days more easily, I can tell you.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be the one to scare you anytime soon compared to those other scares.
I want to mention a second report from Alex. Go ahead. That he did go to court on Thursday with... We have a sign, free speech is not domestic terrorism. That what's your name, sir? Show me your ID.
I'm just Dennis of the OSC.
I see. You are the Occupy Santa Cruz. And we have actually another individual here from San Jose. What's your name?
John Tilking.
And John, you've come over the hill. Why?
Well, I'm doing my Peace Movies project, so there was one movie that was only showing at the Nickelodeon that I wanted to see.
So you're doing research at the Nickelodeon.
Yeah, I can say that.
That's interesting.
And also, I wanted to go out to dinner with some of my friends, so we're going to do that later.
I see. So you're kind of, it's going to be a wine, dine, and shine, or stare approach.
Something like that, yeah.
That's cool.
While we're talking about the NDAA, there's a couple other bills that are working their way through Congress. One is a bill that would strip U.S. citizenship from someone who gets detained. And another one makes it illegal to, it's already been passed by the Congress, makes it illegal to protest inside any building where there's a Secret Service agent protecting someone like a presidential candidate. I'm not sure if it would specifically outlaw protesting at the DNC or the RNC later this summer, but you know, it'd probably be okay to protest inside the protest pens, but you for sure cannot go inside the building where the candidates are.
Now, we know that protests can be a deadly weapon.
Right.
Fair enough. Well, welcome to Santa Cruz.